Hello and welcome to the Leaders Sport Business Podcast. It's another episode of the podcast about leaders in sport from Leaders in Sport. My name is James Emmett. I'm the editorial director here at Leaders. And with me, as ever, is my great good friend and colleague, David Cushman. David, how are you?
Well, thank you. They come around quick, these podcasts, don't they?
It's every Tuesday we record, David. Comes around. It's more or less every 7 days. It's a working week.
Indeed, indeed. But delighted to be here once again.
Yes. Here we are. How are you doing, David?
Very well, thank you.
What's coming up on the show, please?
On the show, yeah. We have a guest. We have a guest this week. His name is Tom Waterhouse. He's the VP of Rights Strategy at DAZN, which promises to be a fascinating conversation about the sports rights market in general, DAZN specifically.
And value rights, even?
Indeed. Well, what does a VP of Rights Strategy actually do? Because it's an interesting job title.
Yeah, it is.
We'll find out about all of that, and we will be delving a little bit into the exciting and growing world of MMA to talk about DAZN's joint venture with the Professional Fighters League, PFL, in Europe. And Tom will be able to give us the skinny on that. James, I know you're not a big mixed martial arts fan.
No, but I went for a coffee with Tom Waterhouse's colleague Dan Johnson the other day.
Yes.
And can I say, Dan Johnson, who leads on communications for DAZN, used to lead on communications for the Premier League. Can I say that Dan Johnson is an example of a sports industry executive who has, I think, has shed the shackles of the corporate world and become one of the coolest dudes in the industry? Absolutely. I mean, he was looking $1 million when I saw him.
White Americano?
I think it might have been a flat white. No one has a white Americano anymore, David.
Apart from me.
It's just you.
Just
have you tried a flat white?
Yeah, I've tried a flat white.
Okay.
I just find it... I find it
a bit gritty. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the landscape in the world of mixed martial arts that we're going to talk about, I think it's worth us just setting the scene, a little bit of context.
Before. So you've got UFC, right? That's the big one.
UFC is the number one. Tailor the tape here, James. UFC founded what year?
Ooh. 96?
93.
Oh.
But really supercharged in 2001 when the Fertitta brothers took it over, installed Dana White as president. The rest is history. Now, of course, under the TKO umbrella, the Endeavor created company alongside WWE. Then you've got PFL created.
You're going to have to tell me.
2018.
Okay.
Don Davis, venture capitalist, the founder, and PFL has positioned itself as the challenger, a challenger to UFC. There's a big mountain to climb to get there, but it's made some interesting moves over recent months to try and do so. This regional model, one of which is Europe and the joint venture with DAZN that Tom will no doubt talk to us about. Some investment from Saudi Arabia as well in PFL, and they bought or merged with, but effectively took over the running of Bellator, the number three MMA promotion. And then, of course, you've got one championship in there as well, which you are familiar with. You've done many interviews with interviews even with Chatri
Sichatong, the founder of One Championship. What a man.
Founded 2001.
Yes, and sort of a reality show kind of built around it, around him.
Coming out of Asia, ambitions to internationalize, and it creates this very crowded, cluttered, growing market.
Yes. And what we're seeing actually in the fight sports space is an increasing amount of crossover. So I guess this is a trend that's happening in fight sports in general, but really what we're seeing is fighters, whatever discipline and whatever promotion they're fighting in, kind of building their own stardom, their own followers, and then being promoted in some kind of unusual crossover fight. We're seeing influencers come into boxing, coming into MMA. We're seeing MMA fighters transcending the particular promotion they're in. There's a lot of teamwork going on, weirdly, a splintered world of fight sports. But it is an interesting landscape, and looking forward to having Tom come in and give his kind of technical rights view on that landscape. But David, what else? What have you been doing over this last 7 days? Anything good? Did you go to the Olivier's?
I didn't, but one of the hot ticket items in London this weekend. Well, I took another of my famous long weekends, James, yes. actually. But then you and I were in the studio yesterday over at IMG. Mm-hmm. We recorded an interview with Barbara Slater, the outgoing director of sport at the BBC, which will be... putting out in the next couple of weeks or so.
We did. And we head off to Stockley Park IMG Studios once a month to record these big interviews, Leaders in Focus interviews that we put out on the podcast stream. And we record them every on Mondays. And Mondays seem to be the day that Ian Wright comes into Stockley Park to record his bit for Premier League Productions. There's always a troop of ex-footballers milling around in Stockley Park. Yesterday, I bumped into Matt Holland coming out of the shower just opposite my my dressing room.
Did you?
Yeah, of course.
Opposite your dressing
room?
Yeah,
it was opposite my dressing room.
I don't remember getting a dressing room.
You did have one, David, but you don't use it. You go and eat the biscuits instead, don't you, upstairs in the canteen. Anyway, Ian Wright, having seen him for several sort of monthly Mondays now in a row, one of the loudest, most gregarious people in sports broadcasting. You can't fail to hear his voice anywhere around Stockley Park. And I would say a treasure of the PLP production world, but also I'd say probably approaching national treasure status now, Ian Wright. His track record in sports broadcasting and football broadcasting, and it was a relatively recent role as the champion for women's sport and the kind of visible male ally for this surge in popularity for women's football, is something to behold. What a man.
What a man.
Anyway, we talked to Barbara Slater. Oh, man. it was actually lovely to see. We did the interview. Barbara Slater wraps up, goes off, and Ian Wright was entering the building at the same time. They had a very warm embrace and a lovely chat together. Barbara has obviously worked very closely with Ian in Ian's role as a Match of the Day pundit for many, many years. So it was lovely to see that. Lovely to see that.
Indeed. And we hope an interesting, but we hope an enjoyable interview for people to watch, enjoyable conversation as Barbara Slater looks back on her time at the BBC and looks ahead a little bit to how the sports rights world might evolve.
Can I just, what's that tinkle, tinkle, tinkle? Is that the sound of a bellwether going off? Can I say something about music? Is that okay? Before we get going?
Yeah, if you'd like.
Well, it's come to my attention that Coachella, the music festival, started this past weekend. And Coachella is an absolute behemoth of a music festival. Kicks off the summer of festivals over in the Palm Springs desert in the US. Goes on for multiple weeks. I think it's 3 weekends it goes on for, which is insane. But the first weekend, Blur played to an apathetic crowd. Grimes played a DJ set that was going at double speed, and she was sort of screaming in frustration along with it. It wasn't anything to do with her controls. It was beset with problems. And I was reading about it, and apparently this is sort of common practice for this festival. The first weekend, always there's loads of problems. And I
really?
Think that is absolutely shocking and slapdash, considering this is supposed to be a sort of poster child for music events in the US. It's the music event in the US. And the fact that you have to almost write off the opening weekend because there are going to be technical challenges, particularly when a pass for the weekend costs $499 at the low end. The reason I ring the bellwether is because I feel like music festivals, there is some sort of learning that you can take from what's going on in music festivals into sports events. If music festivals aren't doing well or are doing well, there's a corresponding thing happening in sports events, I think. You know, it's people's appetite for major events, and Coachella ticket sales are down and very slow this year. And clearly people are not going to have had an amazing time this first weekend. So after a record year last year, big dip this year. 125,000 first weekend tickets took a sluggish 27 days to sell.
Crikey. Mm. Crikey. Well,
anyway,
that's the music news.
That's the music news. Anything else to tell you about? Airbnb is down as well. People aren't booking Airbnb here in the UK.
Although, did you see the graphic? They were absolutely booking out the path of the solar eclipse recently in the US. There's an interesting graphic that appeared across social media of Airbnb bookings.
Do you know what? That's amazing. It's really interesting to be part of a group here at Leaders, which has a sizable contingent over in the US. We're in the same group, Leaders Group, as Sports Business Journal, and a lot of our leadership is based out in the US. And it's one of these sort of world moments, I think, which it's like the World Series in any given US sport, where it took on this kind of international momentousness for everyone based in the US, and obviously absolutely no impact whatsoever anywhere else in the world, because we didn't have an eclipse, of course.
Sports industry lessons from the eclipse is a LinkedIn post waiting to be written, isn't it?
Yeah. 11 things you need to change about your marketing strategy post-eclipse.
Indeed, indeed. Tom Waterhouse from DAZN is coming imminently. First though, James, shall we do a spot of news?
Yes, let's do it, David. You turn this way, I'll turn that way, and together we'll have the full 360 covered. This is 180 seconds of Sports Biz.
French President Emmanuel Macron has suggested for the first time that the opening ceremony of Paris 2024 could move from the River Seine in the event of security threats. Options to adapt the ambitious plan for a parade of athletes down the river include a more limited route or a move to the Stade de France. Macron, who's also pushing for an Olympic truce during the Games, says there is a plan B or a plan C in place should it be needed.
World Athletics' surprise announcement last week that it will become the first international federation to award prize money directly to athletes at the Olympics this summer is set to spark a wider debate about athlete remuneration. World Athletics is making available $2.4 million to reward gold medalists in Paris with $50,000 each. It will broaden the prize pool for the next Olympics in 2028. The IOC was only informed of the news as the decision was being announced.
Alex Kajelski is the BBC's new director of sport. Kajelski joined the corporation from The Athletic, where he oversaw the launch of the UK division. Hired by BBC chief content officer Charlotte Moore, he takes over at the BBC from the retiring Barbara Slater, and he'll begin work in June. And you can watch, as mentioned, an in-depth conversation with Barbara Slater reflecting on her time running BBC Sport in a couple of weeks on the next edition of Leaders in Focus.
The UK's major athletics promoters, UK Athletics, the Great Run Company and London Marathon Events, are forming a new joint venture, Athletics Ventures, to deliver major athletics events and try to spur the growth of the sport in the UK. The new venture will deliver the 2026 European Athletics Championships in Birmingham, as well as the UK's annual Diamond League meeting. It will lead a UK bid for the 2029 World Athletics Championships. The new company is also launching a new playground to podium sponsorship platform with a range of assets covering national events, UK athletics teams and grassroots programmes. Governing body UK Athletics reported a record annual loss of £3.7 million last year, put down mainly to the investment required to stage major events like the Diamond League.
The Women's Super League has confirmed stopgap extensions to media rights deals with the BBC and Sky. The existing broadcast setup will continue next season as the newly restructured WSL organisation seeks a longer-term solution which will yield higher revenues. Meanwhile, the BBC, ITV and Channel 4 are all reportedly bidding for the UK rights to next year's Rugby World Cup. The women's tournament is being played in England.
In New York, city officials have approved plans for the new private funded football stadium for Major League Soccer's New York City FC. The $780 million stadium is part of a larger development project and will be the city's first stadium dedicated to professional soccer. It's scheduled to open in 2027.
Sports and comedy quintet Dude Perfect has received $100 million in growth capital from Highmount Capital as the next step in expanding the brand. The online entertainers will use the investment to help fund new projects and creative partnerships, as well as building out a robust management team. Dude Perfect is currently building a major production and entertainment destination in Texas.
And Dana White has confirmed Conor McGregor will return to the octagon when he fights Michael Chandler in July at UFC 303 in Las Vegas. McGregor, MMA's biggest star, has not fought for 3 years. And that was 180 seconds of Sports Biz. Now, we're delighted to be joined in the studio by Tom Waterhouse. What, Tom Waterhouse?
That's the one, yeah. Tom Waterhouse.
I don't know what I was about to say.
Do you want to start again?
Tom Waterhouse. Waterhouse. What a way to spend the weekend. Tom Waterhouse, VP of Rights Strategy at DAZN. Tom, thank you very much for being with us. Tom, before we get cracking on dipping into these news stories, just want to... want to understand how you explain yourself in non-sports circles. If you're at one of your fancy dinner parties and you're sort of trying to explain to someone what you do, VP of Rights Strategy at DAZN,
yeah.
How do you do it?
Well, it is a challenge. Uh-huh. I used to be a lawyer. That was a lot easier to say. Lawyer. I'm a lawyer.
You know where you are with lawyers.
Yeah. I work for... I mean, I was previously at the business when it was Perform, and that was also quite a challenging business to explain. But I think at least now, explaining that I work for a sports broadcaster is a useful starting point and something that everyone knows what that is. But in terms of what I do in what the rights team do at DAZN, we are essentially the team that's responsible for... looking at our existing portfolio of rights in our core markets and assessing, you know, what's working, what's not working, what we should be looking at renewing and how those rights are performing. But also we are, you know, incredibly outward looking and opportunistic. So a big part of my role and what the team does is really looking at new opportunities and working with much brighter people than us in the strategy team at assessing kind of what those opportunities are and whether they make sense for us to execute. So yeah, it's very much a kind of strategy role from a kind of acquisition and management of our current portfolio and then and kind of more future looking as well.
I always think it's interesting how many lawyers kind of progress into the world of rights, media rights, contracts in sports contracts. So not necessarily that surprising, but it does strike me that... media rights, it's all about numbers, right? And valuations and working out return, a lot of spreadsheet work. But lawyers, obviously, that's attention to detail, scrutiny, that's words, contracts, very specific wording. Are you more of a words guy or a numbers guy?
I leave a lot of the actual crunching of numbers in an Excel to other smarter people. But yeah, I mean, you have to certainly have a be comfortable looking at the numbers, interpreting the data, and I think, yeah, from my perspective, my background and my in fact, when I joined the commercial team, we were going through the fun phase of COVID, and that was very much everyone in the rights team getting out the contracts and having to be lawyers. So, looking at force majeure provisions that no one had looked at. I think it certainly helps to have some of that background contract knowledge, but you have to learn to leave the details behind and really focus on the important commercial pieces.
Does DAZN actually use Excel?
I try not to, but
we all try not to.
There's about three people in the business who are very good with it.
I actually found
I know exactly what you're going to say. Go on.
Do you?
Yeah, I think
I
so.
I was clearing out some stuff I had in my parents' house the other day, and I got my old pencil case from school with my scientific calculator in it. I haven't used a physical calculator for about 20 years. I really enjoyed pressing it.
That's not what I thought you were going to say.
What did you think I was going to say?
I thought you were going to say. I thought you were going to excitedly announce, as you have a habit of doing.
A new function on Excel.
A new function on Excel that you've learned.
I'm not allowed to announce new Microsoft features on this podcast
anymore. No.
Should we dip into one or two of these stories from the topical roundup? One that I'm not sure. Is this strictly a new thing? This World Athletics paying prize money at the Olympics?
It is somewhat a new thing
okay.
for an announcement about payments direct to athletes.
Right.
So there is obviously a pot of revenue that the IOC distributes to international federations, and historically, those international federations, in the way that they see fit, have redistributed those funds further down into various parts of their organization, and athlete training, for example, would be one of those. I think this is pretty significant. This is World Athletics announcing that it will award prize money to gold medalists in the athletics at Paris 2024, a pot of $2.4 million. As we said, $50,000 each across all the various disciplines, and a plan to broaden that prize pool out for the next Olympics in LA to anybody finishing on the podium and winning a medal. So there's a few things going on here. Obviously, there is this long-standing structure around the Olympics where athletes effectively do not get paid directly. Mm-hmm. And World Athletics is shaking the tree in that respect. And this has been led, it seems, very much front and center in the announcement, as you would expect, by World Athletics President Seb Coe, Lord Coe. And he is quoted as saying, whilst it's impossible to put a marketable value on winning an Olympic medal or on the commitment and focus it takes to even represent your country in the Olympic Games, I think it's important we start somewhere and make sure some of the revenues generated by our athletes are directly returned to those who make the Games the global spectacle that it is. Fair argument.
Yeah.
But I think genuinely an argument and genuinely a discussion. So some bits and pieces here that I think are interesting. Is this simply the latest in several moves around the future of the IOC leadership and presidency? It has long been speculated that Seb Coe is positioning himself as a contender to be the next president of the IOC. Thomas Bach, the incumbent, is due to give up the role next year, although there has been some speculation that there might be moves by IOC members to try and extend his term for another 4 years, which would currently be against IOC rules. So there's a bit of that at play, the constant politics we see around the IOC. I think this number is interesting, though, $50,000, which is, it's a lot of money, but it's not a huge amount of money in professional sports terms. And I feel like that is quite a carefully calibrated number by World Athletics. It feels like it's high enough to spark a debate that Seb Coe and World Athletics clearly want to have. But it's low enough, I think, that it doesn't cause major uproar or exert huge pressure on other international sports federations.
It's a number that other federations could follow, potentially, given the money that they also receive from the IOC, right?
Yes, yeah. But I don't think it exerts too much pressure on them to do so, or create major, major global headlines in the same way as if the World Athletics suddenly announced they were giving away hundreds of millions of dollars to winners. I think the wider picture here is really fascinating in that we are going through the Paris cycle, coming to the end of that, and then we're going into an Olympics that are taking place in LA. And I do think that the way that athletes are paid and whether they are paid is going to become an increasingly big discussion, not just in Olympic circles, Olympic rings, but across US sport. We know what's going on in college sports, name, image, likeness. There is a big discussion already there. And I think the Olympics naturally gravitating towards LA, as they will do, as the games there approach, is going to put a real focus on how athletes and whether Olympic athletes should be paid for, as Seb Coe says, being the stars of the show.
And when you say athletes, it's really athletics as well, you know, track and field, and especially track, which has become this sort of interesting ground for experimentation, right? Because there are these competitions apparently springing up from all over the place. Mm-hmm. There are these multi-sport games which are attracting a degree of controversy, the friendship games.
$100 million prize pot, $100
million
in theory.
Prize pot, apparently, for this sort of Russia-backed new multi-sport games. There's the juiced-up dope games, or what's it called?
The enhanced games?
That's right. The enhanced games, which is the drugs spectacle.
Yeah.
I imagine there'll be some prize money there. That's Gladiator. With on the track, right?
Yeah, I think that's being pitched as a multi-sport event when actually it's a reality TV show.
Sure, yeah. Sure. But then you've got Michael Johnson's very real new athletic startup, which should be coming soon, coming down the line. And I guess the core intention there is to liven up the way athletics is produced and to return some new revenue to the competitors. So, interesting new players and a response from World Athletics, really.
And interesting sports, of course, in the Olympics, because aside from, you know, the more, quote, amateur sports where athletes tend to be, you know, paid less well, you, of course, have golf now, you have tennis, you have football to a degree, certainly some star players. You've got cricket coming in 2028. And this is a debate that we have seen around the Ryder Cup last year, for example, about whether golfers should be paid to participate in the Ryder Cup. And it raises all these questions about national prestige, you know, pride in representing your country, and whether that outweighs the desire to be paid effectively. And with the Olympics,
nice to be proud and paid.
Well, true. And with the Olympics, does the history, does the tradition of the Olympics supersede actually getting some money in your bank account at the end of it? Interesting questions, and I think questions that absolutely aren't going away for the IOC, and World Athletics has put that firmly on radar and on the agenda. And just as a maybe a final note on this, coming back to perhaps this being a move in SEBCO on maneuvers for the IOC presidency, very notable that the IOC was only informed about this as the decision was being announced. So an element of the IOC being blindsided by what is quite a significant announcement by a very significant Olympic sport about a pretty fundamental change to the way that the monetary structures work in Olympic world.
Yes, indeed. Should we talk about a different story? I was particularly interested in the appointment of a new director of BBC Sport.
Yes.
For a couple of reasons.
Go on.
David, as you know, this week recorded a show which we'll be putting out in a few weeks with the outgoing director of sport for the BBC, Barbara Slater.
It wasn't a formal HR exit interview, but it did have that sort of overtone to it, I felt.
Well, interrogation style, obviously blindfold. We did waterboarding as per. And, you know, Barbara spat out the goods in the end.
Yeah, and signed all the forms at the end.
Signed all the forms. So that'll be coming soon. Really interesting appointment, I think, in a role that is both technically really challenging and also sort of really symbolically important, I think, in the kind of UK sporting landscape. And Alex Kajelski is the man who's coming in to replace Barbara Slater. He'll be taking up the post in the summer. Coming from The Athletic, as we mentioned, he's a man with a fantastic journalistic newsroom track record, less experience on the broadcast side. What do we think the challenges are ahead for? I mean, Barbara Slater was there since 2009. She has gone through a period of big transition at the BBC. Tom, what do you think the challenges are facing the new director of sport for the BBC?
Well, I mean, it's an exciting gig, I'm sure, but it's there's some pretty well documented big challenges that you're going to face in that role. I think they are now really in a space where they are going to struggle to compete, obviously, for the big premium rights, and there's probably a question about the sustainability of some of the listed events that they've got. And obviously, they are working to some pretty restrictive funding arrangements that others in the space aren't having to. So I think, it's a really interesting set of challenges that that they've got. It's a really interesting appointment, I think. They've obviously gone for someone who's got a bit of a reputation for disrupting and innovating. I mean, I'm a massive fan of The Athletic. I think what he's done there is you know, obviously seemingly been a very big part of the disruption in that kind of digital editorial space. So it's interesting that the BBC have gone out and targeted someone with that background and maybe looking for someone who can come at it with that approach and that skill set of what can they do to innovate and disrupt a bit. So it will be really interesting to see if he's kind of backed to do that and how they look to actually, you know, let him take on that role and come maybe redefine slightly what sport means to the BBC, maybe moving away slightly from rights and more towards kind of digital storytelling. And, you know, they've done some really interesting stuff in recent times around clips and what they've been able to do there, maybe less so on the kind of pure live side of things. But
it's something that was kind of reiterated for me and David when we spoke to Barbara this week. The scope and the breadth of what BBC Sport does. A lot of people, when you talk about BBC Sport, you think about the live broadcasts that they do. You think about the Olympics. You probably think about all the sports that they used to have on that they can't get on anymore. But radio, journalism, digital live coverage, like BBC Sport encompasses so many different kind of objectives and audience reach goals. And really interesting, Barbara came from, you know, worked her way through the BBC. Obviously, she had a broadcast background, a broadcast production background. Alex is completely different, right? He's got journalism and digital. I guess with an appointment like that, yes, you're looking for a disruptive force, new ideas, new generation, new background. But you're probably looking to double down on the BBC's position as the sort of go-to digital access point for sport in the UK, right?
Absolutely. And broader picture, of course, the BBC has a license fee review coming up. I think it's 2027. So the process is already underway.
I think it's being raised this year, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The process to get towards whatever the final result is already getting underway. I hear everything you're saying, but I think still the most visible bit of BBC Sport is the live sport.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that gets picked up by media and can often be the stick with which media beats up on the BBC. And I was just, as you were talking, totting up. I'm afraid I was taking some of my notes while you were talking, James. But if you think from a broadcast point of view, what the BBC has, and probably from a perception standpoint as much as anything, can't afford to lose, Match of the Day, which is sewn up for another cycle as a sort of great brand, Olympics coverage, which we know is now, you know, has been remodeled, but still very substantial, as we'll see this summer, World Cup 2026, you would imagine the BBC ITV monopoly on that would probably continue. Wimbledon, I think, you know, has a sort of almost outsized importance in terms of the relationship, such a long-standing deal. And then probably from a radio standpoint, you know, there's lots of rights, and that is a competitive rights landscape now in the UK with TalkSport buying more rights. But I think something like Test Match Special and retaining enough rights to make Test Match Special continue as a, you know, a sort of premium BBC brand is pretty critical, because losing any of those,
yeah,
and that becomes a big media story.
I think something that Alex will, you know, he'll have to learn the broadcast, the right side of it, right? The doing a lot with a little, which is what the BBC's challenge is. But it's interesting the way the BBC seems to have gone down this route in recent years of championing partnerships with pay broadcasters, so they will be included in deal structures where the majority of a sport or a competition is shown on Sky or on DAZN or on a pay platform, and then the BBC will have a small smattering, and they'll, you know, the property will get the reach that way. That is a model that DAZN have gone down once or twice, right? The kind of partnership with free-to-air platforms.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, from a women's sport point of view as well, I mean, what we've done historically with something like the Women's Champions League, where, you know, we've wanted to combine that model of making sure that we're putting it in front of a paywall, but also keeping some of it behind a paywall previously, and seeing how that model worked. We've now obviously taken the strategic decision with all of our women's football to actually put that entirely in front of the paywall. But I think it was an interesting learning for us, seeing how it worked with having some of that viewership being driven purely through YouTube with that partnership, and also how that impacted, you know, what we were doing on our own platform behind the paywall.
What are the factors that go into a decision like that? Because that's something that, I guess, one of the other stories we had is the WSL generating a bit of competition in the market for its rights, extended its sort of current deal by a year, more as a holding kind of pattern as anything new. DAZN, obviously, with this big women's sports property, yeah. DAZN, a big champion of women's sports and active in the women's rights market. Obviously, this shift to going back in front of a paywall, mm-hmm. is that from the outside, without going into the nuts and bolts, it looks like you had a go at charging for it. It didn't work out. You didn't generate the number that you wanted. Let's go back to the old strategy. I imagine it's a bit more complicated than that.
It is. I mean, ultimately for us, we've obviously taken that as our strategic decision at the moment. We now have freemium functionality, which we didn't have previously. We have that globally now. So it was an opportunity to reassess what we were doing with those rights. I think we, as you say, we've taken the strategic decision to put all of our women's football content in front of a paywall. The results so far have been really successful. I mean, viewership's been strong, and it's also allowing us to, open up a lot of really big conversations with brands and partnerships. We've done, you know, deals with really big brands, Amazon, Adidas, Visa, and I think it's a real opportunity to actually try and, construct some of the rights deals in a way that allows the kind of the whole piece to grow for everyone. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are a global digital service with really fantastic distribution. We're in a position where we can actually work with rights holders and brands and commercial partners if we can construct deals in the right way to actually ensure that, you know, we're doing what we can, but we know others can bring and lend assets in a different way to us. And actually, you know, if we can get that buy-in from brands and work together in a way and construct that flexibly, we can grow and make sure that it's done in a way that actually everyone's working with those shared objectives.
A lot of that decision-making, I would imagine, is data-driven. And I know data is pretty much at the heart of everything you do on the Excel sheets and probably elsewhere.
Actually, there's a new function on Excel that I'm on.
Save it. In amongst all the science, how much room, if any, is there for gut feel when you are in the process of making decisions on what rights to buy?
Fundamentally, yeah, we're an OTT service, so we have a huge amount of, you know, rich and very granular consumption and engagement data that we have access to and access to very quickly. And actually, we use a lot of third-party data as well. Fundamentally, that's what has to inform the modeling and the decisions we make. I think, you know, we are always going to be expected to justify any decisions we're making with data, but that said, there's always got to be space for intuition. I think, as I said earlier, we're very opportunistic and outward looking, and I think particularly when we're looking at new market opportunities, we don't necessarily have the data from our own platform to rely on, and there you do have to be a little bit more interpretive of what you're looking at. We obviously have a wealth of experience now. We're in a very different place now to where we were at launch in 2016. We've seen what works and what doesn't work in our core markets in Italy and Spain, Germany, Japan, and on the global service as well. So I think, you know, there is, with that experience, you begin to inform decisions and have a bit of a playbook about what isn't working. But yeah, fundamentally, we're never going to be in a position where we're always going to be very much kind of data driven primarily, and it's really those kind of fine margin decisions maybe where you start thinking, actually, let's rely on what we've seen, let's think a bit more from a kind of intuition perspective about what's going to work here.
Looking a bit more broadly at the rights market in general, you've obviously got global rights with PFL, you've got a global deal with Matchroom Boxing, And we've obviously also seen the Apple MLS deal has been, you know, one that has made lots and lots of news, lots and lots of headlines over the past year or so. The global approach versus the market by market selling approach.
Netflix WWE.
What are you learning through those sort of global deals that you have that perhaps you don't get from the market by market approach you've taken elsewhere, and I guess vice versa?
I mean, it's obviously a big challenge for us to actually come up with those opportunities that work on a global basis. And I guess with a lot of rights, we've got to go to the rights holder and actually demonstrate that we are the best place across all markets to broadcast their rights, right? We don't want to just be a dark market solution where rights holders can't get distribution. So I think what we've done with boxing and women's football, they're obviously very different properties and require quite different strategies. But I think our ambition was very much to become the global home. And I think we've very successfully achieved that with both of those. We've become, we've got a really strong brand association now, I think. And people see us as the place to go to get, you know, and trust us with our kind of output for boxing and women's football. But I think there's only so far you can run that model with certain rights holders. We're having to get quite creative about how we can think about that model with other rights holders. I think our NFL relationship is a really good example of that. We had NFL Game Pass in a single market. We were running it exclusively on DAZN in Canada. We had those rights for a number of years. We did a really good job of demonstrating to NFL the growth that we could deliver in that market. And, you know, the kind of end goal, or well, it wasn't necessarily the end goal, but what the result of that has been that we've obviously been trusted by the NFL to do a 10-year deal to be the exclusive distributor of their Game Pass service outside of the US and China. And I think that's the kind of, you know, the different models that we can start to look at to see, you know, how can we construct these kind of global deals with certain rights holders where they still might be going market by market with their traditional broadcast deals. It's something that we've got a lot of those similar deals in the pipeline, and we've recently announced a deal with Rally TV and a deal with FIBA for their courtside service and a number of other deals. So it's really a model that we are looking to replicate. And I think ultimately it's good for the fans as well. You're creating something that's very much easier in terms of discoverability. It's a much simpler and clearer marketing message. But I think we know that there will always be rights holders, or certainly in the short term, there'll be rights holders that are always going to favor going market by market. And with certain rights holders, there's not a huge amount of influence maybe we can have there. So Premier League or UEFA, for example, the traditional model works very well for them. But in those instances, you know, we found a way. It obviously works very well for us too. I mean, we have domestic Serie A, domestic Bundesliga, domestic La Liga rights. We're one of the biggest licensees for UEFA. So, you know, we found a way. We obviously make both models work. And I think for us in the future, it's very much going to be a case of, you know, trying to be nimble as both of those approaches evolve. I think, you know, ultimately we need to have flexibility both from a kind of product capability perspective, but also a strategy perspective to work in both scenarios to make sure that we can tailor what we're offering to rights holders in those scenarios.
Let's talk about PFL for a bit, if we can, because it's really interesting. It seems, at least, like it's a really interesting and unusual rights model there, in that DAZN has a joint venture with PFL, but only in Europe, right? Not
correct,
globally.
Yeah.
Why? Why not just pursue a more traditional rights leasing model? Why go in as partners?
Yeah. So that's exactly right. So it's the PFL Europe venture that we have created this JV. So it's a, you know, a new regional European league. It's a venture in which we have an equity stake, we have a seat on the board, and then alongside that, we are also the exclusive broadcast licensee in a number of markets. It's not global, but we have their rights in a wide range of markets, primarily Europe and APAC, but also some markets outside of that. In terms of why it's constructed that way, I mean, I think for us, you know, we saw great potential with this partnership, and there's a lot of synergies between the parties in terms of strategy and outlook, and you know, we both see ourselves as looking to do some really innovative, exciting things. Ultimately, in this instance, it's a JV, but fundamentally, we are really keen to push for long-term partnerships with rights holders. Mm-hmm. I mean, in this case, obviously, we've both got an equity stake here. So naturally, we're going to be aligned on goals and have shared incentives for growth. And that is going to necessitate a very collaborative approach between the parties. So, it's helpful to obviously, but beyond that, if it's not an equity JV, we're still looking for ways, like I said, with NFL to create these long-term partnerships. Ultimately, in a lot of cases, we want to move away from the short-term transactional model where it's essentially, like you say, you're renting the rights for 3, 4, 5 years, paying your check and then coming back and seeing each other for renewal discussions. Mm-hmm. In the current climate, I think the best way to ensure that you are growing the property is to have that certainty that you are able to invest on a long-term basis. It's best mm-hmm. for us as a broadcaster, but it's definitely best for a rights holder and for mm-hmm. their property.
When a deal like that, or when that specific deal was being cooked up, a JV between a broadcaster and DAZN and a property in PFL, when does rights strategy, the rights strategy department, get brought into the conversation? How early on are you involved? Is it sort of retrofitting a strategy to kind of a corporate done deal, or is it early on in the piece and trying to build?
Are you asking, is that a long-winded way of asking when Tom gets access to the Excel sheet?
As early as possible.
Yeah, the password is given.
I mean, it varies. I mean, ultimately, this is a joint venture that exists regardless of our kind of broadcast rights. Like I say, we have the broadcast rights in a number of markets, but we've seen and we believe in the growth potential of this property, regardless of whether we are the kind of broadcast licensee. So, of course, there's modelling that's done our side in terms of assessing what that value is, but it's not the case that we've alongside that decided that we absolutely want to take, we haven't necessarily taken these rights globally. So it's obviously a factor in the process, but maybe those JV discussions, it's not really the case that the rights team are central to those at formation, for sure.
What's the crossover like between boxing fans and, or boxing viewers and combat sports, MMA?
We have to be, I think, a little bit careful sometimes to make sure we're not, thinking with a combat fight sports umbrella, because I think it can be a bit of a lazy way to sort of bucket users. I mean, obviously, we can see with consumption that there's naturally some crossover, and it probably varies between, because I mean, outside of boxing, it's still quite broad, right? People might assume that MMA and kickboxing, Muay Thai are all, largely the same and have the same fan base and users. But
go on certain bits of the internet and they'll put you right on that quite
exactly.
Yeah.
And regionally there are obviously properties that resonate incredibly strongly in certain regions that, don't really have much of a fan base at all elsewhere. So I think there's certainly a crossover and there's great synergies for us in what we can do, given we are a really established boxing brand globally. And I think we're able to then go to rights holders and demonstrate what we've done in that space. And it certainly makes it, I think, a lot easier to construct some of these deals and have those conversations. But I think, from a strategy point of view and assessing the value, it's not necessary. And also from a kind of marketing perspective, you definitely can't just assume this is just all one big bucket that you're targeting and the same fan base.
And I suppose the other way that you might slice and dice your viewers for any given property would be around the hardcore fans of a particular sport or event and serving the more casual fans. Yeah. So what's the balance to be struck in terms of super serving one group but bringing in another?
I mean, the answer, which is probably a bit of a simplistic one, but ultimately we do want to be doing both, of course. I'm sure like every sport and broadcaster would say the same thing.
Can both be done?
I mean, we definitely feel like we're doing that. I think first and foremost, taking the example of PFL Europe, we want to make sure that we've got a really fantastic product for the fans and primarily for those hardcore fans, that we are definitely serving that fan base. And with PFL Europe, there are some really unique selling points of that promotion. You know, it's a league format, so you get that regular season playoff championship flow, and that's obviously really helpful in terms of ensuring that the best fighters are fighting the best. And we've got that proper schedule of events. Maybe you don't get that with all fight promotions. It's helpful for us from a broadcast perspective to have that certainty. It's really helpful to kind of serve those fans and tell them what they're going to be getting. But also the fantastic element of PFL Europe for serving those hardcore fans is the regional element. I mean, there are massive swathes probably of Europe who feel underserved by MMA offerings, particularly when they're having to stay up till middle of the night to watch stuff in the US. What we're doing with this league is it's a regional league that we are bringing to those markets. We had an incredibly successful event last month in Paris, a real landmark event for us, with a PFL Europe event where we had Cedric Dumbe, French fighter, against another fighter, Baki, as the main event, and other French fighters on the card. I mean, Dumbe is a genuine superstar in France, so it created huge hype, amazing interest, huge success for us. But it was a real example of what you can do if you take that property and serve it to fans, you know, where they are at a time zone that is prime time for them. We'll be doing something similar, hopefully, with the next event in Newcastle, where Savannah Marshall, who's from the Northeast, is fighting back in Newcastle, and then we're excited about what we can do there too. But
didn't Dumbe get a splinter?
Yeah, I mean the outcome of that event, maybe the hype and the interest in it was great.
Oh, you've got a lot of signups, right?
Huge
a lot
success
of
it, for us. Yes, very very odd. I don't know if you saw that one, but yeah, shard of glass in the foot, which led to a slightly unfortunate stoppage.
That sounds a bit more dramatic than a splinter.
Well, he couldn't he basically couldn't do the fight. He wasn't allowed to take the splinter out. It's like golf rules, Dave. You've got to play yeah, the ball as it lies. Yeah.
But I mean, ultimately, that's how we definitely feel we're serving that hardcore. But from a kind of casual fan perspective and how we're reaching new audiences and growing that fan base, I mean, we are, I think, fairly uniquely placed as a global sports platform. We talk a lot about being a global sports destination. We're not just a kind of content platform to house live and video on demand. We are wanting to grow those, you know, other elements and come up with some really exciting functionality in that immersive entertainment experience that you can do around sport. And I think that's a really, you know, compelling way to try and bring in some of those new fans and audiences. As I mentioned with the women's football, we've also got the free tier now. So again, that allows us to be you know, smart around how we're looking to blend content across free and pay, and obviously with Fight Sports pay-per-view as well. So there's a real blend there of how can you bring people onto the platform as free users, casuals, and then keep them on there and grow them ultimately into hardcore fans as well. We've also got the benefit of our big core markets as well, where we can kind of cross-pollinate people who are on platform, you know, millions of users coming on to watch big European football or motorsports, and then, you know, serve them. Like I say, with the PFL Europe, you can serve them some really compelling content that's going to resonate locally and try and convert those casuals into hardcore.
One more before we come on to the hotly anticipated recommendations section of the podcast. I know you've got one up your sleeve, Dave.
Yes.
The path to profitability. People talk about the journey that DAZN is going on and the, you know, ultimately the model that is going to yield profit. Obviously, Shai Segev has come in relatively recently as the CEO there with he's come from a big betting background. The direction of travel seems to be towards betting being part of that model. I wonder, in the right strategy team, how much that's playing into how you do modeling now. Are you specifically looking at gaming-friendly sports, or, you know, how to move users towards that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an element now where we're wanting to be conscious of where those opportunities are. Of course, I mean, it's a big, you know, we are a sports OTT service, but as I say, we want to be a sports destination. So, like you say, betting, e-commerce, ticketing, you know, we've got deals in place now with Fanatics and with Daimani, and these are areas that we are really focusing on building out, because they are a critical part, as you say, of that road to profitability for us. We really need to you know, grow those ancillary revenues and those additional pieces that we can bring in. So they are a hugely important part of what we're going to be doing. We are, with DAZN Bet, it exists in European markets, and it's something that obviously we are factoring in when we are looking at rights acquisitions in those markets, and it's another revenue line on the modeling when we're looking at that. But it's, you know, that's the case for we can get really creative now with what we're doing from an advertising perspective with the platform. Now we have a lot of really new and interesting ways that we can sell ads in and around our content. So I think, you know, it's not just betting. There's a whole load of ancillary revenues that get factored in now to all of our modeling when we're looking at new rights. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Recommendation time. Tom, do you have anything for us? Something you've watched or read or heard?
I mean, it's...
or just seen.
Yeah, I was going to say, not particularly cultural one. But we were discussing just before the pod about the troubles of having young kids and not being able to watch much sports content
anymore. The joys of having
I don't think
kids.
We said troubles. Yeah, Tom, just to be clear.
Yeah. Troubles specifically. I've just thoroughly enjoyed watching. I mean, it's not a particularly cultural recommendation, but I just, the Masters week for me every year is just like the most lovely sporting event, and being able to have it at a time zone where kids go to bed and you can stick that on for 4 hours. It's just
for a horrible second there, Tom, I thought you were going to say the new episode of Bluey that dropped at the weekend.
I will be. We'll be looking that one up too.
James, oh no, famously, you don't have a recommendation this week, do you?
Famously, I don't. I did watch the Masters though. I really enjoyed it. It's just, I forget. I mean, I know it's a double-edged sword because of the amount of water that they use to make this show, but it's just a feast for the eyes, isn't it?
It's amazing, yeah.
The greens and the pinks, etc. Absolutely love it. Although I do find, I'm not sure, I can't remember the last time I watched it on Sky. I appreciate it's been on Sky for a long time, but I definitely recall the BBC coverage, and I'm not sure that it was quite so patronising in tone before, in terms of them telling me what a treat it was.
There is a lot of that.
Do they play in the Birdsong?
We'll have to talk to a sound, not, a sound guy.
Yeah, should we not open that
Pandora's box? Do we want to know how the sausage is made?
In addition to the Birdsong at the Masters, I have started listening and can thoroughly recommend a new, relatively new podcast series that I happened upon completely accidentally, but is excellent. It's called Heroes and Humans of Football. It is presented by Simon Cooper, who is the Financial Times columnist, journalist, excellent voice on all things football and the social, political impact of football, and Marine Khan, who is the economic editor at the Times. And they have come together to produce these deep dives. Every episode is focused on one subject. So it caught my attention with the episode they did on Roman Abramovich, which charts his rise and the Chelsea years and then fall through the sort of politics and his background. You know, their quest is to talk about and discuss and discover the human behind the hero. And they've done...
And they went with Roman Abramovich.
Went with Roman Abramovich as an interesting, I think, first or second choice. They've done Pep Guardiola, which is really interesting. The Kylian Mbappe episode, I wouldn't know, you know me, James, I wouldn't probably tune into a episode of anything really that was focused on a footballer, but absolutely fascinating, the story of Kylian Mbappe, his importance now as a symbol to France, and obviously this actually highly politically charged move that he's about to make, it seems, away from Paris okay. to Madrid. Yeah, Mo Salah's the latest edition, so look it up. It's called Heroes and Humans of Football, and
Pep Guardiola.
I think it's genuinely excellent.
Pep Guardiola, Mo Salah, Kylian Mbappe, and Roman Abramovich.
They're the first four, yes.
The heroes.
Well, look, I'm not...
Heroes in its broadest
term. And actually, with Abramovich, the point that was being made, I think, was that actually, regardless of anything else that's happened in his life, mm-hmm. in recent times or previous to his Chelsea ownership... Mm-hmm. Because of his Chelsea ownership, he is something of a hero still to a bunch of Chelsea fans.
And on that note, let's call it a day. Tom, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
No worries at all. David, see you next week.
See you then.